So on behalf of the Crick Jacob Center for Theoretical and Computational Biology, I'd like to welcome you all to the Brenner Lectures 2009. Sidney Brenner is a distinguished senior fellow in the Crick Jacob Center, and we're very fortunate that he has been a frequent advisor, plotter, and imaginer of what the center can become in terms of our program, scientific program, and the different people that we are attracting to the center. Now, I've divided all of Sidney's life into three parts, like Gall, and you're going to be hearing the first third of his life in this introduction, and in the subsequent two lectures tomorrow at 1 p.m. and on Friday, the final lecture at 4 p.m., you'll hear the other parts of his life. Sidney was born on the 13th of January in 1927 in a small town in South Africa, Germiston. His parents immigrated there from Eastern Europe. And he was precocious. He learned how to read at a very early age, and in 1 year passed through three primary grades, just to give you an idea of his ability to absorb knowledge already at that age. He discovered the public library, where he continued to devour books, sources of knowledge that has really served as a fundamental basis for his entire career. And I can assure you that he's still a collector of books and still reads. We were discussing just before the lecture some of the volumes that he has acquired and how he's acquired them in very interesting ways. And you'll be hearing about that a little bit later. Now, there's a few things. First of all, he had a chemistry set when he was young. And one of the first questions he asked was, what causes flowers to have their colors? And what he discovered, in his astonishment, was that if he changed the pH of the solution, he could change the color, which is an interesting observation. And I think this is a key. He has a really keen eye. Observations are something that he's been very, very good at following up on. Now, he wasn't always a good student. He decided to go to medical school, and I'm going to quote here from his autobiography. I was not a good medical student and had an erratic career, brilliant in some subjects, absolutely dismal in others. In my final year, I failed medicine, scraped through surgery, but got a first-class degree in a third subject, and guess what that is? Obstetrics and gynecology. But he did graduate from medical school, and he also did teaching part of his training. He taught neuroanatomy, and one of his students, who was 2 years behind him, was Max Cowan, who later, as you well know, became a very famous neuroanatomist and was here at the Salk Institute for many years. So I think we have Sidney to thank for the start of Max's career. Now, I want to now break off because the watershed moment is one that is really a transitional one for him. And this is the moment when, after his medical school degree, he went to Oxford to do a postdoc. And it was there that he heard about the model of DNA that Watson and Crick had put together. And in a very famous trip between Oxford and Cambridge, together with Leslie Orgel and several others, they were probably one of the first few human beings on the planet who actually saw what the structure of DNA looked like. And that must have been a momentous moment, and it certainly changed his life. Today, he's going to be telling us about his insights into systems biology. You'll be hearing about inverse problems and many others. Sidney.
Thank you. Thank you, and I'm very pleased to see an audience that is many young people, so that my inclusion doesn't raise the average age too much. So I'd like to tell you about the source of these lectures first. In 2001, I was asked to give 3 lectures in Princeton on subjects I'd been interested in for the last 10 years. And I was also invited to come and give some talks at Rockefeller Institute, Rockefeller University, otherwise known as RockTech. And I decided that I would reverse what they do with Broadway plays. That is, Broadway plays are first put on in sort of places like Princeton before they brought to New York. But I decided I'd try it out in New York before I took it to Princeton. But the titles of these lectures, there were 3 of them, and the first one was called Drowning in a Sea of Data and Starving for Knowledge. Today I would say Thirsting for Knowledge. The second lecture was entitled Does E. coli Understand Itself? And the last lecture is called Reconstructing the Past, which I think is the challenging problem that we have today. And so these 3 do echo those themes, which is how are we going to understand complexity, and they also have some interesting aspects in that they could all be given quite appropriate Shakespearean titles. If I had 5 lectures, I can tell you what the other 2 might have been called, but I don't know what the science part would have been. Right, so what I'd like to begin with is, why do I say reading the human genome? About a year and a half ago, I discovered no one has actually read it. The only things that have read the entire genome from beginning to end are computers. Right? And so, in fact, if you try to find out what there is in the genome, the only ones who have the global view of this are computers. And as we know, computers are incredibly stupid. They may be obedient, but they're stupid. So all of this has been trundled through computers without anybody applying any thought to it. And so the question I decided, well, you know, someone has got to start to find out what's actually in it. Because as you know, when they first decided to sequence the human genome, they said, this is like sending a man to the moon. It's exactly so, because sending a man to the moon is easy. It's bringing him back that's the problem. Right? So I want to bring the human genome back from the moon where it's stranded. And that is why these things present a really interesting challenge, because everybody knows the interpretation of what's there is going to be the significant thing. And the question is, what can we extract from this? As you know, all living systems have a complete description of themselves, but written in this very strange language. They're the only complex systems which are specified by an internal language. And of course, if we read this, technically we should understand any organism that we can imagine. But effectively, this cannot be done. So the challenge is, can we compute, ultimate challenge is, can we compute organisms from their DNA sequences? You know, could I look at a sequence and say, my God, you know, that's a three-toed sloth. Today you can't do it. As I've said to many people, you know, if I was a doctor, I could say, I've got these two patients. The one has got a hell of a lot of hair, a long tail, and his feet are like hands. I've got the complete sequence of these guys. Please tell me which are the genes that create these differences. Of course, one is the chimpanzee, and the other could be you or me. And so the fact that we are completely lost in telling that just shows you why we've got to start really reading the human genome. It also allows me to illustrate what I think is the important theme that I think is beginning to dominate the whole of biology, which is the growth of factory science. Right? So as you know, today everybody believes we have the capacity to make an atom-by-atom description of everything in the universe. You know, we just need to raise the money to do this and hire the machines and we'll do it. But of course, the question is, will you understand anything? Okay, because understanding requires something more. And I think the thing that is missing in the whole of biology is a theoretical framework in which to assemble all of this data. And that is really the theme of this, of these three lectures. What is the theoretical framework in which we can do, assemble all of this data and come to understand biology? Well, you might say, well, you know, there are lots of sequences. But I came to the conclusion, you know, if I could understand man, then mice would be easy. So it's best to start with the human genome and leave mice to our successors, where they can then enjoy themselves doing that. Well, as you know, there's now a new field of science, biology, called systems biology. In fact, there's an even newer one called synthetic biology, and its only virtue, I think, is if it could replace systems biology. But basically, you have to ask, what is systems biology? What is its program, whether the people know it or not? What are they aiming to do? And if you try to look for a definition or even a prescription of the area this composes, it's impossible to find. Sometimes it sounds like a subject some of us studied called physiology, but others, it's all got very different connotations. But I think there is a formal sense in which we can attack this and simply ask, can you do it? I mean, if you had a real scientific program, could you, by making observations, go from the observations to the way the thing works inside? In other words, this is one of the classic formulations of what is called an inverse problem. An inverse problem maps the data space, the observational space, onto the model parameter space. And the question is, can you do that? Now, there's another problem which is called a forward problem, in which you know how it works, but you can compute the outcome. It's always often a good test of whether you got the right model. And I think that, if you like, this is the fundamental difference if there is to be a content, an intellectual content assigned to these, between what I call systems biology, which intends to solve the inverse problem, and what I think we can call computational biology, which says, no, we're going to solve the forward problem. Well, let me give you an example so that you can see. I mean, this was all formulated originally in the theory of partial differential equations by a great French mathematician called Hadamard, who, by the way, I discovered from Wikipedia, was a brother-in-law to Dreyfus, of the very famous Dreyfus case in France. So that's an interesting thing. But however, and he formulated what you had to do with mathematical systems, which is that effectively you could think of mathematical systems going in two directions. For example, the inverse of differentiation is integration. And you could then ask, if you're going to look for equations, if you're going to look for solutions, what did you have to find? What did you have to prove to have valid solutions? And he laid down three criteria. First of all, you should show that a solution exists. Secondly, you should show that it's unique. And thirdly, that it's stable under all conditions. All right, and we're going to come indeed. And he said that a problem which is put in this form would be called well-posed. In other words, can I find a solution to this problem that has the character of that it exists, that it's unique, and that it's stable to many conditions? He called these well-posed problems. Now, it turns out that most inverse problems are ill-posed, which is the often. In other words, they cannot be put into this form. They then, as effectively you will learn later, that to solve an ill-posed problem, you have to do something, all right? And so this process is called regularization. It is very common in many areas of science, that you try to regularize it. You regularize it either by looking if the most difficult inverse problems are those that involve non-linearities, so you can try and linearize it or only solve the problem over a linear domain, or you can only solve it only for certain conditions. So basically, what we're asking is the following, just to bring this all down to the real world. You're in this room, and in another room there's a man playing a drum. Right? Now, we've rigged this so there's lots of microphones in there, and you've got all the tools you like to analyze the sounds made by the microphone. All right, the question is, can you deduce from those the physical parameters? Tell me what the size of the drum is, what it's made out of. In other words, tell me how it works to generate this. Now, that's a typical inverse problem. It can't be done, because most inverse problems cannot be done because, A, the data is not accurate enough, there's interference, and so you can go one way, but not the other way. But if I had the drum, I could certainly compute the sounds that this would make, right, by just knowing the physical features of the drum. So the forward problem can be solved. It's just a problem in physics. The inverse problem cannot be solved, right? I'm going to give you another classic one that you may have heard about, is can you read the structure of a molecule from a diffraction diagram? Answer is no, because information is missing, right? And what you measure on the diffraction spot is the square of the intensity. The intensity of the light. That means this is effectively the square of the amplitude. What is missing is the phase, because minus one and plus one have the same square, right? So you can't tell whether it's up or down. So how do you solve this? Well, a lot of people felt at the time, I just have to fiddle around and I have to do other projections. But it is technically insoluble, as stated, because there's not enough information to do this. Right. Now, how actually it's interesting to see how it might have been solved. Right? So in the present day, if we were faced with this, we would say, oh, that's very easy. What we'll do is, because we can compute the thing, we'll just go on and we'll try all the phases. Okay? Now, that works if the molecules are small, because the number of reflections grows with the cube of the size of the molecules. But when you have, say, 1,000 reflections to do, and you have 2 to the 1,000 possibilities of combinations, then you better start thinking about how long this is going to take, because actually the number is bigger than all the number of elementary particles in the universe. So it can't be computed, right? So you can't just try things and try all possibilities. It's not possible, right? You can do another thing, which is, you can add a priori information. Okay, you can say, well, you know, I can see there are certain features, and then I'll make a model from other information. This is exactly what Watson and Crick did. Okay? Because they could see there were certain features that told them these are helical model molecules. Right? And then you can compute the diffraction diagram from such models. Okay. And in fact, you would have to show, and typically, that there were no other models could give the same thing. That's the uniqueness. All right. And the third way is get the information. That's what Max Perutz did to solve protein crystals. He measured the phase. He did it by a trick. Once you measure the phase, it's straightforward. All right, so let's just ask our friends, the systems biologists, what they intend by this to tell us. And I'll show you why their thing is impossible to do. So the idea has come now from doing the human genome and with the whole growth of what I call really spectroscopy, that you can collect lots of data at the same time, you see. You know, this whole business of saying, why do one gene that when you can do 1,000? Or, as Pat Brown once said to me, more is better, to which my reply was, the least is best. So there's other principles of how you should approach this. But the idea that you could do massive data collection using chips and all this sort of thing has empowered the people with the idea that we have now multidimensional data points. And couldn't we deduce what is going on inside, make models of what is going on inside from a consideration of these data points? Right? So the answer is that basically you can't do it, and I want to just show you why there are fundamental reasons that you can't do it. So what we would like is to have, at the end of the day, on each part of the model, we'd like a number. Right? So if a gene is being expressed as this level, because most of them involve measuring the levels of expression, then that number, whatever it is translated backwards through the system into something that has a sequence information. You know, whether it is that, yes, a transcription factor has to bind to the sequence and stimulate the RNA polymerase, all of that is set by sequence information, right? And that means that it's been under selection, natural selection, and that therefore that number is fixed. And of course, what we'd like to do is map the data that we measure onto that set of numbers. That's the actual thing we're trying to do. Now, of course, this means we have to make the measurements very accurately. And already the thing has fallen down on that. Okay, because you can't make the measurements accurately. But let me just say that there's another more fundamental reason why this is not possible. Because if there is no selection for fixing that number, that is, it's not a fixed number, but it's a don't care condition. You know, you can vary this by 10, it won't affect the organism. Therefore, there'll be no natural selection. So the significance of something going up by 10 may be mistaken in measuring, in trying to deduce the model, because you've not understood that what has generated this is an evolutionary process, and that there is not only good and bad, there's also indifferent, right? And those are the things that just make an evolutionary system incapable of judging whether this number is really significant or not. There are many examples of this. I'll just give you one of these. When you activate a lymphocyte, right, you will find that there's an induction of a protein sequence which other places is processed to give you enkephalin, which is a kind of internal opiate. That then generated a whole new science that said, ha-ha, the immunology and the brain are related. So there was a whole thing called neuroimmunology that, you know, the lymphocytes were sort of little neurons, or possibly neurons were big lymphocytes, and so we could unify this field. When you look into it more carefully, you discover although this is induced and although the protein is made, it's never not processed. Okay, it's just metabolized. Right, now how does this work? What is the meaning of this? Because if we were measuring RNA, we would suddenly find here's an opiate produced by B cells or T cells when you activate it. The reason is that there is a machinery which the cell uses to switch on a lot of things at the same time. They're called the immediate early functions. They found on in virus infection, they found on various things. All right? So, what you need in order to process enkephalin is a whole lot of machinery. You need to put it into a secretory granule. You need to have peptidases that process it into the peptide. And that's absent in the lymphocyte. So nature has decided, well, I like this. If you put it in this anthropomorphic way, I like to have something that switches on everything simultaneously to give, you know, to give me the defense. And if you say, well, what's the use of having an opiate in the B cell? Well, if it doesn't harm anything, I don't have to provide any more information. Okay, if it did harm, then nature would have evolved a way to cancel it. So we have these things, and I can tell you that it is rife. Biological systems are rife with things that have to come through the process of natural selection. So the first thing you've got to ask of any data, What is the evolutionary meaning, if you like, of this number going up? Right? You can't just use it in an artificial way. Okay. So, I believe that the whole program of systems biology is doomed. I mean, it's doomed from the moment you start. Maybe a good way to raise money, but it's doomed as something that will give us an answer. So what's the alternative? So I want to give you some many examples that sometimes you do all of this experimentation and you discover that the standard technique, I should say, is you make this measurement and then you do cluster analysis. Okay? You see, basically it's what is called the first law of sociobiology, is that those who pray together stay together. And it's those who go up together, which stay together. So you cluster them according to properties. Okay, and then these clusters become significant things in a gigantic network that is built up, in which the Tokyo subway system would be a trivial example of what there is going on inside the cell, if you've seen some of these diagrams with everything joined. There's now a whole thing about networks being produced now. And if you look at these, you have to analyze, there are hubs, and you have to ask, what is the meaning of a hub? So very recently, somebody produced a whole network about T cells. And what was very interesting is that one of these hubs turns out to be all the things going on in the lysosome, which is the kind of guts of the cell. And of course, all these things involve proteases and so on. So, but instead of doing all of this, if you just had a look at the cell, all right, you would have found this not as a deduced from this network diagram of association, but simply something you should have put into the start. Right? So what I'm going to describe in the remaining part of my talk is the alternative and why we must construct it in this way. Right? So the alternative I've talked about for many years now is something called cell map. All right. And what does it start? It says, if we deal with biology, what is the level of abstraction that we should choose? Right? Because that's very important. So people say, as I was asked today by someone, do you start the organism and work your way down? That would be top down. Or do you start at the bottom with atoms and molecules and work your way out? Bottom up. And the answer is no. You start in the middle and work your way out. So middle out. Right? So what is the unit we should talk about in biology? Oh, we've known it for more than 150 years. It's called the cell. Okay? The cell is the unit that we take. Sometimes the whole organism is one cell. But the organisms like ourselves, we all started as one cell, which divided and did all the things to produce us. And so we ask ourselves, taking the level of the cell, we can look down at the molecules, and we can look up at the organism. And basically, what we can do is have the same logical structure all the way down. In fact, you can carry it even further. So we have that a cell consists of a network of molecules, and the organism consists of a network of cells. Right? So if we are dealing at one of these levels, we ask ourselves, to which of these things do we have to reduce it to? Right? So everybody will tell you that reductionism won't work. They'll tell you things like the whole is the sum of the parts. The whole is not the sum of the parts. They'll talk about emergent phenomena. Now, all of this is rubbish, basically. It says a true quotation is the whole is not greater than the sum of the parts. Okay. It's greater than the sum of the parts, each studied in isolation, because what the whole is the sum of the parts and their interactions. In fact, the best way to look at it is to say, you got all the stuff there, you compute the whole from these interactions. Okay? And you can't hide away from... By using words like emergence. They don't mean anything because they like to say some magic happens along the way, you know, and it emerges. It doesn't emerge. It's actually computed by the things. Otherwise, you couldn't make organisms. So that's the job of nature. So we must understand it that way. All right? So... we don't have to deduce at all from Schrödinger's equation. I mean, that's just ridiculous reductionism. But we can do it in stages. That is, I'd like at least people in psychology to know that there is a brain and the things that are working there on neurons. I don't necessarily want them to know the molecular biology of how voltage activated channel works. It's too low a level for their phenomena. So this I call pragmatic reductionism. Reduce it to the next level, which effectively computes your level, okay? Computes your behavior, right? Because we're not going to go, like inverse systems goes, from behavior or function, from behavior to componentry, we're going to go from componentry to behavior. Then we think we have the explanation. Okay, so that gets rid of another one of these things that we're told that can't work, right? So we want to do the cell, right? So I now look at the human genome, and I'm told there are 27,000 genes there, and probably in any given cell type, let's say there are 20,000 active, some common, some special. All right? So that's 20,000 polypeptide chains. All right? And if I put them, had them all expressed at the same time, how the hell does the thing work? I mean, you know, because we know that the complexity of the system is very difficult to specify in this case, and that there must be some way of dealing with it. Now, the implication you get from reading some of the more daring systems biologists is, you know, given a set of partial differential equations, we'll be able to solve this. Right? And the answer is no, never, right? And this means one lesson that I want you all to remember from this lecture is the best way you can understand an organism is to put yourself in the organism's shoes. Like, if you can't do it, E. coli certainly can't do it. So E. coli must have found a way to solve this problem by other means, right? And that is precisely it's Brenner's principle of evolution, which is that organisms treat everything like income tax. It's criminal to evade income tax, but they're legal means of avoidance. So what's the best way of dealing with complexity? Find a legal way of getting around it. Simplify. That's what organisms know how to do, right? Now, how do they do it? So the first thing we look at, just knowing a little bit of molecular biology and so on, is that single polypeptide chains hardly ever work alone in a cell. Right? What you find is that they are in things called molecular assemblages. They are built into devices, molecular devices. Right? And if you look through and just find out what is this is all done, you will discover that on average, just as a good back-of-the-envelope calculation, that there's about 10 components on average for each of these devices. And so we've immediately reduced the complexity by doing it in two stages, modularizing it, if you will, by an order of magnitude. So instead of thinking about 20,000 polypeptide chains, we only have to think about 2,000 entities like this. Now, the other thing is that the cell is not a uniform solution of everything. It's compartmentalized. And what goes on in the nucleus is different from what goes on in the plasma membrane. So let's take another 10 compartments to do this. So we now have in each of these about 200 entities. Right. And now we can see that if we do this on a basis of doing these, if you like, clusterings, that effectively we've got a way of trying to grasp how the thing works. And I think that that is the most important principle here. Now, what is the principle involved? There are a lot of people in the world who say that they like to dispense with molecular biology. Okay, they simply like to deal with pathways or concepts like this. But I tell you, if you want to solve biological problem, struggle though you might, you cannot evade molecules. Because as I said before, the essence of biological system is that they're specified by genes. Okay, the genes are molecules, and it works through making other molecules. So if we tackle the molecular problems, then I think the way is clear. And I'd like to give you one example very quickly. It's still incomplete because the information is not incomplete. If a drug company comes to me and said, I got this drug and it inhibits the beta adrenergic receptor, can you tell me what it'll do to the heart? See, so we say, okay, so we go out, we kill an animal, we bring it into the lab and we put the drug on this and we show the guy, you know, this. But the question is, could we actually compute that? Do we know enough of the system that we could say, well, if you inhibit this or you activate this, this is what will happen? Right? Because that's his prediction, the calculation that we could actually then. Because then, if we can do this, we can generalize the system, because we understand how it works, and you don't have to go and do it in the real world. You can make a prediction. You know, I would not use this one because X, Y, and Z. Right? So that is the, if you like, is the kind of objective we should aim at. Right? Can we do that? So we go through this and we know that what this does is go through a whole lot of steps, but eventually it will generate cyclic AMP. All right? And the cyclic AMP will be generated, and what we know happens then is that a little channel is opened and some calcium escapes, comes into the cytosol of the cell. So, what we'd like to know, first understand, is how does all of this work? So we look at this called the ryanodine receptor, and we look to see what are the components of it, And at first it seems completely bizarre, because a very important component of it is an enzyme that destroys cyclic AMP, the cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase. But it's very interesting, because this enzyme has low activity. Right? So cyclic AMP hits this, it dissociates the catalytic subunit of the kinase, and one of the things the kinase does is to phosphorylate the phosphodiesterase, which activates it. And so it takes a wave and chops it to a delta function. Hey, I heard something like this before. Isn't that the same thing in synapses with acetylcholinesterase? Of course it is. Right? So here is a way that it says that the molecules will only measure the wave. Because if I continued the wave and I didn't have this, they'd all go into complete tetanus. Right? We'd just be continually stimulated. And so for all of these systems, you begin to realize there have to be generalizations of the way they work, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Right? And then this thing goes off and phosphorylates the channel, it opens, it does a lot of other things as well. But now, if we just left it like that, how do we do it again? All right? Because the textbooks would lead you to believe that all of these, you write it down, X goes to Y, that's the end of signal transduction. In other words, you pass the buck to someone else and forget about it. So they have all these things like cascades. In order to use the system again, we must restore it to the ground state. Right? So the prediction is immediately that all these things must oscillate. Right? Otherwise, they won't work. They need to go up and they need to go down. And sure enough, we find the componentry here includes two protein phosphatases. Presumably, one will act to reactivate the phosphodiesterase, inactivated by dephosphorylating it, and the other will close the channel. All right, now. So basically, now you see that I have a machine which can act in order to do this. And basically, you begin to ask yourself, now wait a minute, we've got a problem here, you know, because I think if you allow this thing to be diffused through the cytoplasm, how does it find the right place? And so as we are beginning to learn, all these receptors have a tremendous amount of molecular rearrangement, right? So presumably when this happens, the molecules rotate and are put in contact with their substrate. They don't have to diffuse, right? So it works like a little gadget, a little device. Now I submit the following, that when we've gone through all of this molecular biology and we've understood it and everybody has a good understanding of it, that we can put that under the table. And we can just say, the properties of this device is to transform so much cyclic AMP into so much calcium. In other words, it's got a transfer function. Right. Now, we know very well how to deal with this, right? And because we can then make a description of this gadget's behavior in terms of any model we like. I mean, the most common one is to draw an electronic circuit which mimics all of this, all right? That's the simplest. But we can also put down a mathematical equation. And if we liked, we could make a hydrodynamic, you know, plumbing analog of it. But the basic thing I want to point out is that device language is very well known in many other parts of physics, especially control engineering, that it's available there from at all levels of abstraction, all right, and that we must now understand these molecular devices in those terms. Okay. And I submit, if we then go down the line, we have the same problem with what does the calcium do? Well, we know what that does. It'll activate the heart muscle, but it'll do a lot of other things. And so therefore, by actually having this, you should be able to calculate what happens with all of these things. So somebody once asked me in a talk, what do we do about error propagation? That will never work. So, well, of course, I have the ready answer. Well, if it doesn't work that way, let's find out how biology avoided getting trapped. Right? We know about error propagation, that it's very difficult to do anything by dead reckoning. In the very early days of working with robots, they designed robots to solve geographical problems. I mean, they put it in a room with a lot of things in the way, and they asked the robot to find a path through these obstructions. And so the robot had a map of the room, and it could then calculate, knew where the obstructions are, so it could calculate, you know, move so many things to the right, turn left. And these were all translated into pulses to little stepping motors, and the thing is that most of them fell out of the window, okay? Because dead reckoning, the errors propagate and get worse. The thing only became realistic when at each stage the robot was given a television camera and said, you know, take a look, see where you are, and if you're not where you think you are, adjust your position to that, okay? So there will be feedback devices, and almost certainly those are the ones we will find by exploring the system in great detail. All right, and so we should be doing this for all of these things. So when we say interactions, from this point of view, I want you to understand that we have what I call strong forces or strong interactions, which are the way you make these assemblages. And from everything we know in molecular biology, each of those can ultimately be described in terms of DNA sequence, you know, which specifies an alpha helix here. You needn't worry about this. The molecular biologist will sort it out for you. But effectively, that can be given this, and we know now that the instructions in the genome read build a device to do the following, right? And this is what we have to do. So if I try to see where are these devices on the genome, they're not in any one place. They're all over the place. You know, this protein's on this chromosome, this protein's on another one, this peptide appears in many guises, in different places. Sometimes I have a specific one, the one in the heart's not the same as the one in the brain. All of that has to be packed into our reading of the genome. So, I'd like to conclude by saying, all those who think that systems biology is going to lead them somewhere are wrong. And it is much ado about nothing. Thank you very much.
So we have time for some questions. I'd like just to point out that there's another famous inverse problem in vision. So in the case of vision, the inverse problem is to go from an image on the retina, which is two-dimensional, to your internal perception of the three-dimensional world. The forward problem is graphics. Given a model of the world projected onto a two-dimensional image. The animators and the graphics designers have taken that to a fine art, to the point where it's almost realistic, all practical purposes. However, computer vision people still haven't solved the inverse problem. And what we can see, nature has solved it, but the evidence is coming out that it doesn't create a completely accurate internal model. Mm-hmm. It's actually putting together fragments of components and images that are needed to solve the problem at hand, and that's why you have a fovea that's jumping around three times a second.
Yeah.
So nature has had to deal with this on many different levels, not just at the level of single cells, but at the level of the whole organism.
Thanks, Terry. I should tell you that astronomy is full of such inverse problems as well.
Terry, could I remind people that if they want to ask a question, it'd be useful if you could wait until we get a microphone to you so that we can actually get this on tape as well. Somehow we'll manage to wade through all the blood from all the sacred cows that Sydney has slaughtered in his talk. Anybody have... Elaine?
Okay, I'm not so sure we should slaughter system biologists so quickly. And I'll bring two examples where I think they actually bring something that enriches our vision. I think one is the contingency of the item. So when we take a look at systems and we focus on the molecular approach, we fail to see, I think, that these things are contingent. So if we think of biology in the largest way that we could possibly think of it, as in other beings that could live on other planets, the particular molecules will not make a difference necessarily. They might give us insight, but we can imagine something that is much broader. So an example would be something like Hebb, who has given us a way of thinking of networks that really preceded much of the discoveries that are taking place today. The second thing I would say is context. So what a systems biologist would say is, one of the claims he made very early in the talk was that the code is there, and the systems biologist would say, no, absolutely not. That's exactly how you get into trouble. So if you're looking at from a molecular perspective, that's the road you're going to go down, and you're going to think that a cell, all your information is there, where in fact it's not true. You cannot figure out what a cell will do unless you know the environment. In fact, most of the time, cellular biologists are spending trying to figure out what temperature, other molecules we have to stick in there to make the cell survive. So I would say those would be the two immediate concerns, so contingency and context.
Well, I think that as a quick answer to those, I try not to think about the adaptive phenomena because I think those are separate. And I think you definitely have to have the environment. The one thing you'll not be able to deduce very well, except in a few cases, is the structure of the environment from the genome. I mean, that's going too far. But I think we may get on with that once we begin to consider natural selection. But I do agree with you that adaptive phenomena. But let me tell you one thing about the Hebb analog, right? He gave it in terms of neurons. Okay? I don't want him to give it in terms of all the blatancy of receptors. So he gave it in terms of neurons and not in terms of abstract principles. In fact, we have something called a Hebb neuron. So basically, he did what I consider to be the level of abstraction, and I agree, had he tried to go further down, it would have been irrelevant. So other people will fill in that. So I think that for each group, it's like... So you just simply have to choose the generative level. That's all we're asking. Okay, which will generate the behavior? And part of what we're asking you to do in terms of thinking about science is to remember that everything has had to have been constructed, right? And adaptive behavior is a very important feature of animals. And I think it definitely involves the environment. But many things are non-contingent. And that's what I'm interested in.
Sydney, I had the pleasure of sitting through your lectures at Rockefeller in 2001. And now I'm sitting here again. This is Terry. and
the joke's on you.
And the biggest thing that's changed between 2001 and now, in terms of what knowledge do we have, what data have we been gathering, is the negative data, the microRNAs, the variant splicing that leaves out an exon. And this changes these devices in fundamental ways. Have you thought about looking at what's not there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that because when you read the genome, you will find, and that I'll deal with in my later talks, the notion of a gene is obsolete. We've got to get rid of it. Because there are many ways of reading the information, each of which has very important functional and necessary things that go with it. So, I mean, you know, I can show you genes that have, I call them instantiations. So what you have to imagine is we have the information there, and I'll deal with it in more detail, and that the organism has a way of compiling that to produce the ultimate function. So this business of saying we've only got 27,000 genes and it's only five times more than E. coli, which is not only depressing, it's insulting at the same time. This is nonsense. I mean, we have probably more than 10 to the 5 instantiated products. So that has been taken, that we really have to go and find, as you will hear in later lectures. Now, of course, every time someone says microRNAs, and you are the one, they say to me, that called it all junk. You see, you were wrong. It's all important. I was asked to recant in public that I'd said the genome was 96% junk. So I did. I said it's 95.8% junk to admit the microRNAs. I mean, you know, it still is mostly junk. Mostly junk. I'll tell you that. But you can actually see some use to be made of it, not by organisms, but by us. So basically, you're right. We need to do this. And we need somehow to be able to crystallize this in a way that we come to understand it. So that's all I'm asking for. But I think we can go on and measure all the behavior as just like the chap listening to the drum in the room. We can get fancier amplifiers, fancier recording instruments. Best thing is break into the room and play the drum yourself. That's my answer to that. Okay, any more questions?
Over here. So at the beginning of your talk, you spoke about the inverse problem, an ill-posed problem, and how one solution to that is to try to regularize it, and that has many problems with it. But another approach, at least in mathematics, is to not try to regularize it, but instead try to describe the space of possible solutions. Do you see any potential in looking at, instead of a single unique and unstable solution, at looking at the entire space of solutions and trying to get some information there?
Yeah, no, I know that, and I didn't go into it because, you know, it takes us on to the non-criminal use of Bayes' theorem as well. I mean, there are people who think that regularization is criminal activity. Okay, that one should effectively think of this as a statistical variable itself and look at all of this. So I totally agree with that. But again, I come on to the question that is always, you know, we've got to build these things, or these things have got to be built. All right, so part of that is going to be included in all of this. And it's I think, we have to take that view very strongly and also with the kind of boundary that we were not produced by design. Okay, there was no clever engineer to do it. These are products of evolution. Okay, they're going to be full of bodges, lots of sticky tape around this, you know, pins holding everything together. That's because, you see, mathematics is the art of the perfect, and physics is the art of the optimal, but biology is the art of the satisfactory. If it works, fine, keep it. So that's the attitude you've got to have. Don't look for elegant and beautiful solutions. You'll be misled.
So, Sydney, there's another dimension which I think within systems biology, there's an attempt to be complete.
Yeah.
And in fact, your work with C. elegans really illustrated that point very well, that we have a complete knowledge now of every cell in its development, and that really has changed a lot of the way that biology works these days. And I think that that must be part of cell math,
well,
too.
Well, this is the same thing. You see, when I started to work with C. elegans, what I wanted to do was I asked myself, what is the complete solution to a nervous system? When can I say, I've done it all, it's finished, I don't have to do it again? All right? And so I decided that you could only do it, and this comes from many things that von Neumann wrote, okay, when I can compute behavior from a wiring diagram, right? And basically all of biology is computing behavior from some kind of wiring diagram. So the first job was find out what the neurons are, how they are connected, right? That took a long time. I am very pleased to say you can do a whole diagram of C. elegans with modern techniques in less than a week today. It took us 20 years, right? But that's progress. And today I'm delighted to say that we are within sight of what I call the final solution, but people said you shouldn't use those words, so we call it the ultimate solution. Sounds grander. That we can say we know exactly how C. elegans generates locomotion by this concept of computation from the wiring diagram. And what do you have to know to do this? So although that was smuggled into the paper I wrote in 1973, no journal editor would allow you to put things in today. It said this is the program. You have two programs. You can't go from genes to behavior. It's impossible. All right? Which is what Seymour Benzer wanted to do originally. And so what I said is two problems. One is, how do genes build nervous systems? And then the other problem is, how do nervous systems generate behavior? Okay, so one's a problem of developmental biology, and the other's the true neuroscientific problem. And I think with C. elegans, those things are there. And I think they lay the way for establishing criteria for success of these interpretations. Right? Because, you see, we came to the conclusion, logically, I think this was the issue. You want to answer the question which I posed for the drug company on the heart, okay? But you want to be able to answer such questions about C. elegans, you see? So people will say, how does C. elegans behave if it's put in soil at this temperature and this thing? So what we do is we take C. elegans, we put it in. Now, those questions are endless. There's no halting. There's no halting situation for them. On the other hand, if we knew how it worked, we could compute the behavior under all kinds of circumstances, because that is what the understanding is. And I think this, in this finite organism, because the problem, C. elegans was chosen because it was finite. You could come to an end of the description. You could say, as I've always said to the skeptic, who I always thought was there, And, you know, and I described something to him, and he said, how do you know there isn't another wire that, you know, starts in the big toe, runs up at the back, and comes into the eye, and that produces what you're saying? And you have to be able to answer, there are no other wires. We know all the wires. And so I think that complete structure determination, after all, it's just taking anatomy all the way, becomes very significant. And in my belief, we still don't know enough about the anatomy of the human brain. We still need to do more of this and try to get it complete.
Well, it's getting late. I'd like to end with a quote from Sidney Brenner's Nobel Prize address, from his Nobel Prize in 2004 in physiology and medicine. He starts his address with the following statement, that C. elegans is nature's gift to science, and he didn't mean by those the journals.
Yes, it's the only Nobel address that began with a weak joke, with a joke at all. No.
So let's thank Sidney.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, is it 2002?
I'm older than you think I am, you see.